Vitiligo is a lifelong autoimmune skin disease characterized by skin depigmentation that can occur at any age but typically starts before age 20 and can be linked to other conditions. In this dialogue, Dr. Iltefat Hamzavi and Dr. Gary Bronner explore the realities of this often disfiguring and socially difficult disease.
Today we're going to be hearing from Dr. Iltefat Hamzavi, who is Assistant Professor of Dermatology at Wayne State University and Senior Staff Physician at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit. And we're going to be going over the concept of vitiligo and what is new in what is an old and recognized, well-recognized dermatologic disease. We know this is an autoimmune disease, but can you tell me a little bit about what our understanding is, what's going on in the disease, because some very new and exciting ideas have come through laboratory experiments of model systems.
So when you think about vitiligo, the clinical components are strongly correlated with the pathophysiology of the condition. So when you think about it, there's three elements. Number one, there's a trigger factor, which is possibly related to oxidative stress and reactive oxygen species. Secondly, there's an immune component that is triggered by the initial event. And then the third component of vitiligo is melanocyte repopulation. And in those three areas, the trigger factors, the immunopathogenesis, and melanocyte repopulation are where the disease seems to have problems. And if we can address those three areas, you can help address that. The reactive oxygen species theory and the oxidative stress comes from the fact that melanocytes themselves don't grow very well in culture. When you take those melanocytes from a healthy human being and take them from a patient with vitiligo, you find differences in morphology and functioning. And
you're talking about normal skin.
Normal skin.
Normal skin in a vitiligo patient. The melanocytes aren't regular melanocytes.
They're not.
There's something screwy.
Perilesionally. And then the further you get, the more normal they are. And the closer you get to the depigment areas, the more abnormal those melanocytes are. But you can find oxidative stress throughout the body in keratinocytes, in fibroblasts, in melanocytes. So patients with vitiligo actually have a systemic condition, and you can measure the oxidative stress. In addition, if you take immune cells from patients with vitiligo and you transplant them to animal models and you place normal melanocytes there, those immune cells will target the melanocyte and affect its ability to grow. So you've got an abnormal melanocyte, you've got an active immune system to normal melanocytes, and then even if those two processes are controlled, you still have to have melanocytes differentiate from the stem cells in the hair follicle to repopulate the epidermis. So you've got to address all three components of pathogenesis to solve it, and the advances are occurring in all three levels.
Well, let's talk about patients who have vitiligo. Are there certain distinctions now that have been made in where they're categorized in different categories of prognosis based on the location that the vitiligo is occurring? Or is vitiligo vitiligo regardless of where it occurs?
There's significant variation. According to the most recent classification, there's at this point only two recognized classifications. That is the segmental, non-segmental type. But for all intents and purposes, many people feel that there's several variants. There's the acral variant, where you have the hand and the feet, the lips and the tips affected. You have segmental, only one half of a body part is affected. You have the generalized type. And then you have the rapidly progressive unstable type that can progress to universal involvement. Within those four types, the acral type is probably the most difficult to treat. It doesn't respond very well to topical treatments, to phototherapy, to surgical options. The focal segmental type was very difficult to treat until the recent advances in suction blister grafting and even more significant advances of epidermal suspensions have allowed that particular condition to respond better to therapy. And then in generalized vitiligo, where you have patches throughout the body, tends to respond pretty well to phototherapy and some topicals. And focal, generalized kind of go together. And the last category, the rapidly progressive vitiligo, very difficult to treat, but can be managed with systemic agents, such as steroids, Imuran, azathioprine, as well as cyclosporine.
When does this disease occur in patients, and do the patterns differ in terms of age groups? Do children, are they more likely to have segmental vitiligo and adults more likely to have the acral vitiligo, or can any of these types occur at any age?
Any of these types can occur at any age, but definitely vitiligo occurs before the 20s in most patients. And at the same time, you have vitiligo occur in any time in life, but the pediatric population, young adults are probably more affected by this condition than other subgroups.
Is it still thought that vitiligo is an unstable disease, that it occurs, and then it slows down, and it speeds up, and then it slows down unpredictably over years?
I always tell my patients it's a chronic disease. Once you have it, you're going to have it for the rest of your life. Doesn't mean it's going to progress clinically, but the potential's always there. And when you undergo treatment, you always have to plan to go further treatment, even if you have a successful outcome. To go back to your previous point, there are certain subtypes that do occur in certain populations in age groups. So the segmental is more common in the pediatric population. They can also develop a mixed type where they start off at segmental, then progress into the generalized or the acral variants.
Now, you've got patients who become depigmented. They have no protection, natural protection, against sunlight exposure. Do vitiligo patients tend to get skin cancer with an increased risk like albino patients do?
No, not like albino patients. There's two different papers. There's a paper from our group, Melody Ide, our epidemiologist at Henry Ford, did some work, as well as a recent paper from the British Journal of Dermatology. Both papers did not find any cases of melanoma within that population. It seemed to be at a lower risk in the British Journal of Dermatology paper. Our particular group found that in older, fair-type patients, there was a higher risk of basal cell carcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma, but not in the vitiligious areas, and phototherapy and treatment didn't seem to affect it. The consensus seems to be that definitely melanoma seems to be occurring at a lower rate in the vitiligo population, and more than likely non-melanoma skin cancers are also at a lower rate outside of underlying risk factors that might be present in that population. So there may be some protection against melanoma, and that's also being borne out with some of the basic science work that Dr. LaPoole and others have been doing over the years.
Again, too, you've got patients who have an immunologic disease attacking the melanocytes, and they've got white areas they're going to sunburn, so I presume they would be smart enough to stay out of the sun also because they're going to burn otherwise.
Also with albino patients, they have that loss of pigment from day one. Patients with vitiligo develop progressively, and if 80% of our sun exposure occurs before the age of 20, well, that means that if you develop vitiligo slowly, you're not going to have that rapid increase of sun exposure with unprotected skin affected by it.
We've got an immunologic disease. We've got a defective something or other with whatever oxidative stress means, since we need oxidation to keep ourselves going, a little overload of normal processes or something. What other associated diseases occur with vitiligo? We've always been taught that other so-called autoimmune diseases that, again, may not be associated with oxidative stress, but other causes can be associated with, like, alopecia areata or Hashimoto's disease or things like that. Is that still thought to be a cluster group, or are there other new diseases that somehow have been considered associated with vitiligo that represent so-called oxidative stress diseases too?
Well, the primary internal condition that's associated with vitiligo is thyroid abnormalities. And the thyroid abnormality can occur through many, many years. So one of the points that we mentioned to our residents and our trainees is that when you check for a thyroid abnormality, you got to check it every year in a vitiligo patient. And if you look at some work that came out of the Brigham Hospital in Boston, they were able to show that over 25% of patients would eventually develop some form of thyroid abnormalities over a 10-year period of time. So thyroid is by far and away the number one association. And other groups in Canada and Turkey and India have found the same association. There's also rare associations with psoriasis, with alopecia areata. There are also some associations with some neurologic issues in the rapidly progressive type, where you can get this Voigt-Koyanagi-Hirata type syndrome. You can have a uveitis, you can have a type of meningitis, but those are unusual. But if you're in general practice and you're looking at a vitiligo patient the first time, just follow the TSH. I think that's all you really need to do at this time.
So you prefer the TSH as your screening tool rather than antithyroid antibodies?
Correct, because even if you have the antithyroid antibodies being positive, you already know they have a predisposition towards the condition. You're not going to treat them until the TSH changes. And so most endocrinologists that we work with suggest that you follow the TSH, and there are several papers. There's a very large paper that came out of Kashmir in India showing that the microsomal antibodies were predictive of people who would develop thyroid abnormalities. But at the end of the day, you're only going to treat them when the TSH changes.
So you basically are just waiting to see it change.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And that, you just keep going.
Just keep going.
Just keep going with that. And tell the patient, too, if their vitiligo is stable or turned off or whatever, that they've got to make sure their internist follows their TSH.
Every year.
Every year and indefinitely. Okay. So now we've got the patient sitting in front of us, stable or not. How are you going to try to treat them? First of all, they've got white spots, and depending on their native skin color, They've got dark spots. Are you going to cover it? Are you going to have them wear a paper bag on their head or gloves on their hands? They can look like Michael Jackson. How do you cover this disease? Or how do you tell the patients to cover the disease?
Well, first of all, I think one of the points we've got to make is the ability of physicians, especially dermatologists, to counsel patients is critical. If you look at quality of life measures, patients with vitiligo have worse quality of life measures than patients with atopic dermatitis that approaches psoriasis, severe psoriasis. In certain ethnicities, it's at the same level as severe asthma. And so when you find these results that have been published by Dr. Kundu's group at Northwestern, the Saudi groups, as well as Indian groups, we find that across the world. Ethnicity plays a role. So you gotta spend some time and trying to assess how much is affecting the patient. Are they not sleeping well? Are they afraid to engage in social interactions? Is their marriage failing because of this condition?
So you're telling me this is not just a cosmetic problem in these particular patient groups. This really is a life-changing phenomenon.
Oh yeah, no, the Chinese groups just recently presented some studies showing that there's a much higher risk of marital discord and eventually divorces that occurs in patients with vitiligo. And it really affects at the deepest level of your functioning social platform, how you deal with your spouse and everybody else. And a child who has vitiligo is bullied, unfortunately, to a greater degree. They miss more days of school. And again, quality of life indexes are much worse than even the diseases we think about as affecting children to a greater degree. People with vitiligo often will not get married, and in some cultures, and not so much in the United States, but within our own subcultures in the U.S., people who have a grandfather with vitiligo will not marry into those families. And so now your whole life is affected by this condition that some people call cosmetic, but really is a functional issue. So empathy.
So you have to then, as a dermatologist, perhaps pay more attention to history than you ordinarily would, and social history, than you would with other patients and other problems. And I guess this, because this also has a great relevance to the way the insurance world, in the United States at least, that deals with this issue, when every insurance company basically deals with this as a purely cosmetic issue and totally avoid the concept of what's going on with quality of life. So we are the only ones who are gonna have to be patient advocates, I guess, in this area. And if we don't pay attention to it by asking how this disease impacts their lives socially, that we're going to be able to want to be advocates for them. So it is important for all of our listeners to make sure you take a good social history, because it really has a very significant role in these patients' lives. And part of what you're doing, remember, is to reduce their suffering. And that's an important part of reducing their suffering. Let's talk about, again, specifically other treatments. What do you tell patients who are dark-skinned, medium-complected to dark, what do you tell them about covering while you're trying to fiddle with your phototherapy or your other topical agents to see if you're going to get a response? They're still walking around with white fingertips or white lips or white earlobes or something like white elbows with dark skin, and it's very obvious. And I wasn't joking. They're not going to walk around with an abaya on their skin that's covering their entire skin, or they're not going to walk around with a paper bag on their head. Well, what do you tell them?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, we have an excellent patient support group in Detroit at Henry Ford Hospital, and our patients have actually developed some treatment recommendations, camouflage recommendations. So it depends on your skin tone. If a patient has a darker skin tone, the makeup sticks seem to work a little bit better. So we show them how to use those. There's also commercial products that are available where you have more theatrical makeup or makeup that uses powder. And there's also makeups that last for 2-3 days, which can be applied to the skin. So we go over those different options. And if they really want to know the details of where to purchase it and how to apply it, we actually have a patient care representative who's part of our support group who can talk to them about that, which is absolutely critical. Because even that one point in time where you can cover it up really improves at least their ability to function in a social fashion.
So the dermatologists who are listening to this, who obviously don't have support groups in their communities, can approach your support group basically to try to get information or have their patients contact your support group.
Well, we have a Facebook page, and the best thing to do is just go to the Facebook page, find the vitiligo support group in Detroit, and our patient care representatives who are part of that group will contact them. They love hearing from those individuals. Also, the VSI, the Vitiligo Support International, also has some great options. And so you don't have to spend a long time explaining what to do. Just send them over to the patient groups, and they'll customize it to what that patient's looking for.
With a special interest in pigmentary disorders that I have, and seeing patients with vitiligo, I'm amazed at the number of people who come in from other dermatologists who never have that issue addressed. They're willing to treat them, but they seem to forget that these patients are walking around with this disfigurement that's not even being covered, and they're embarrassed by it. So it is important that the patients know, and the dermatologists who are listening know where to get access so the patients can be helped.
That's an excellent question. I'm glad you brought it up, Gary, because it's something I also have to improve in my own counseling my patients.
Well, now let's talk about, we've got them covered up, or they've figured a way of putting some kind of self-tanning lotion or something to make the skin look more natural and less blotchy. And particularly since some of the therapies you're going to use are going to make their normal skin darker and make the contrast even worse. What kinds of therapies have we got now to stop vitiligo and maybe to turn it around?
So stopping and turning around are two different things. So first of all, if it's a localized condition, I always start with topical options. But I also counsel that this will take time. And you're talking about 3 months. And the reason is that it takes up to 42 days for the skin to turn around, and also to address changes in the immune system. It'll take at least 21 to 42 days to see that result. So we do visits every 6 weeks. And we start off usually with ultra potent topical steroids, and we'll use our topical steroids every other day to minimize the risk of atrophy and the other known side effects of ultra potent topical steroids.
So that's once every other day, or
once every other day. And then if that doesn't work, or there's a high risk location on the eyelids or in the face, we'll go to tacrolimus as a different option. If it's rapidly progressive or slowly progressive, we'll often recommend some antioxidant therapy, and there's different antioxidant recommendations of vitamin C's and E's and lipoic acid, but the one that we use in our practice, or I personally use, is ginkgo biloba, which has two control studies showing that's effective. In our own personal experience, it's very helpful in halting progression in many patients, not in everybody. It's relatively inexpensive. You do have to counsel about bleeding risk, so whenever they go in for a dental procedure or something like that, they have to lower the dose or reduce it. But most patients tolerate that very well. So we counsel, start your antioxidant of choice, either vitamin or ginkgo.
What kind of dosing are you talking about for our listeners?
So there's the Activin Green is a glycoflavoglycoside, and it's 14.4 milligrams of the glycoflavoglycoside taken twice a day.
And if they go to a nature food store or their local pharmacy to buy a bottle of ginkgo, it says ginkgo on it. It's not going to have the chemical name. So how much of that should they be taking?
So most of the products in the United States come in 60 milligram tablets. That's just 60 milligrams in the front. We just have them take one tablet twice a day.
Okay, so now you know what dosing listeners to give.
And then the topical steroids, again, every other day, we take pictures because patients are not very good at telling you whether or not they've had a response. Just had a patient a couple of days ago that was in the office, told me that nothing works. Her vitiligo had not gotten any better. Her father was very upset with us, so we pulled up pictures from a year ago. Almost 90% of the pigment had returned. And it completely improved her perception and also the result of the visit. But they needed to see that progression. And they've been very diligent in applying the topical medication. So using pictures, explain that this will take time, is important.
And now they can take pictures of their own cell phones, right? Since everybody's got those kinds of cell phones just about. And they can follow themselves too.
They can, but I encourage you to have your own pictures, because in the visit, it's helpful to have the original baseline. And if you have that, you have your topicals going, you have your antioxidant going, in the focal stages, the earlier stages, you can have a very nice response in many patients.
So basically, we're stuck with topical steroids and calcineurin inhibitors, and that's it.
There are some reports of vitamin D3 analogs being effective. Calcipotriene has been used. It's got equivocal results, some studies showing positive results, some studies showing negative results. We use it occasionally, but not commonly.
Well, I want to thank you for a very enlightening interview, and hopefully a motivational one for our dermatologists, number one, to treat patients with vitiligo and not give up on their patients who have vitiligo. Also, to turn their patients to websites that will provide patient support for them as well, because they now exist and can help them as well. And hopefully society will change a little bit so that patients can get reimbursed for treatment for this condition as well. Thank you again.
Gary, thank you for all your work over the years. You were the first vitiligo working group, and I appreciate the time you took to interview this.
Investigations suggest that there are at least three facets of the pathogenesis of vitiligo, which include a trigger factor thought to be related to a decreased ability of affected melanocytes to adapt to oxidative stress, a cell-mediated immune response against melanocytes, and a decreased ability for melanocyte stem cells and hair follicles to differentiate and repopulate the affected epidermis. In order to treat this disease process, it's been suggested that all three aspects of its underlying pathophysiology should be addressed. The only officially recognized subtypes of vitiligo are segmental and non-segmental, yet many clinicians also recognize acral, generalized, and rapidly progressive subtypes. In addition to describing areas of clinical involvement and disease course, these subtypes have traditionally been helpful for prognosis and in guiding treatment. As examples, the acral subtype is perhaps the most difficult to manage, as was the segmental type prior to advances in surgical treatments such as suction blister grafting and epidermal suspensions. The rapidly progressive subtype of vitiligo is also difficult to treat, but can respond to systemic agents such as corticosteroids and steroid-sparing immunosuppressants such as azathioprine and cyclosporin. Additionally, vitiligo subtypes are not always fixed with pediatric patients, who more commonly than adults have segmental vitiligo and can progress into the generalized or acral variants. While the effects of vitiligo can be disfiguring, it is a skin disease that can affect multiple aspects of a patient's health. Despite a lack of protective skin pigment, recent epidemiologic studies have demonstrated that vitiligo patients, unlike albino patients, have approximately 1/4 the risk of melanoma and 1/5 the risk of non-melanoma skin cancer formation compared to control patient populations, including in depigmented areas. Vitiligo has also long been associated with other autoimmune conditions, yet the strongest association is with thyroid disease. In fact, thyroid abnormalities have been shown to develop in up to 25% of vitiligo patients over a 10-year period, which supports screening thyroid-stimulating hormone, or TSH, levels annually in vitiligo patients. Unfortunately, vitiligo has been shown to have significant social morbidity. Studies demonstrate decreased quality of life scores that are worse than those for atopic dermatitis, comparable to those for severe asthma among certain ethnic groups, and approach those for severe psoriasis. Indeed, it can affect many aspects of a patient's interpersonal interactions, leading to increased rates of marital discord and divorce in some studies. For these reasons, dermatologists must advocate on behalf of patients that vitiligo is much more than a cosmetic problem and should be attuned to the psychosocial aspects of the condition. In particular, dermatologists seeing vitiligo patients need to be sensitive to the disfiguring aspects of the disease and should advise the use of cover-ups and help patients get involved with support groups that can offer tips on coping with the disease while undergoing medical treatment. With regards to treatment, localized disease can often be effectively managed with topicals, but patients must be counseled that it may take up to 3 months to start noticing results. A suggested treatment regimen includes use of superpotent topical steroids once daily, every other day, for 6 weeks, or topical tacrolimus on thin skin areas. Another treatment option for progressive disease is oral antioxidants such as vitamin C, E, or ginkgo biloba supplements, which have clinical evidence supporting their efficacy. For acral vitiligo with fingertip involvement or rapidly progressive vitiligo, the goal is to stabilize the disease, which can be achieved with phototherapy or systemic drugs such as corticosteroids or minocycline. For patients with stable but recalcitrant areas of segmental vitiligo, surgical treatment with melanocyte keratinocyte transplantation or suction blister grafts can be shown to be safe and efficacious. Overall, children tend to respond better and more quickly to topical treatments and phototherapy and maintain their results for longer. When considering escalation of therapy, some authors suggest attempting topical therapy for 3 months prior to a trial of phototherapy for 3 months, followed by surgical treatment options if necessary. For more information on research and new treatments for vitiligo, visit the Vitiligo Working Group website at vitiligoworkinggroup.com. This has been an excellent dialogue about vitiligo. For more treatment options, including ultraviolet therapy and surgical options, visit our app for bonus content on this dialogue. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Dialogues in Dermatology. Next month, we look forward to 3 new dialogues. Remember to download the Dialogues in Dermatology app for your smartphone. We also want you to join us on Facebook for fun, previews, and educational info. This has been Terry Cronin with Dialogues in Dermatology. Stay passionate about dermatology and keep up all the great work you're doing on behalf of your patients. Your expertise and your personal commitment to your patients is priceless. Have another great month.